You're listening to What She Said with Candace Sampson, a podcast for Canadian women about Canadian women. A mansplaining free zone, What She Said is here to empower, educate, and entertain you. Today's episode promises to stir your soul as it delves into human resilience and the profound might of forgiveness. Picture this, a day brimming with joy and aspirations, only for it to shatter into pieces in an instant. My guest today endured just this, when a mere month into her marriage, she was faced with the appalling revelation that her husband had perpetrated horrifying crimes, including the rape and kidnapping of two women. Yet the essence of what we are about to delve into is not anchored in the tragedy, but in the metamorphosis from victimhood to empowerment. A phoenix rising from the ashes, she breathed life into the wreckage, evolving into a guiding light for countless others with forgiveness as her compass. Through books, art, and the spoken word, she advocates fervently for restorative justice, her story serving as both healing and a spark to kindle the fires of recovery in others. Her indomitable spirit demonstrates the boundless strength that can ascend from the abyss of anguish. As we weave through a tale rife with agony, love, sacrifice, and the crowning glory of human triumph, prepare to be captivated. Meet Shannon Maroney. Hi, Shannon. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Candace. Thanks for having me.
It's funny because we're recording this podcast today, but we're meeting in real life tomorrow, which feels a little backwards.
I think it's just the new world order.
So can you start by giving us an overview of your personal story and how it led you to become a trauma therapist?
Sure. Yeah, I was actually a high school counselor in 2005 and had been for a couple of years and very often worked with youth at risk, youth in the justice system and so on, youth who had experienced trauma. But I really, the direction of my work took a big shift when I experienced my own personal trauma. And also involvement in the justice system. So I had just turned 30 in September of 2005, married someone who I would say was a soulmate, Jason, on Thanksgiving weekend. We were very grateful for our lives. Jason had a difficult past history. He had committed a serious offense as a teenager, served time in a prison, and had been living safely and successfully out in the community for several years when I met him. And I became the coldest part of his amazing second chance at life. So when we got married, we had a lot of reverence for his past and what he had done, and also a view toward the future, and so much support from family, friends, and community. And most of all, we just had a wonderful, wonderful relationship. So we married on Thanksgiving weekend, and a month later, I was attending a counseling conference for work when a police officer came to my door, the door of my hotel room, and told me that my husband, Jason, had called 911 the night before asking for help because he had brutally sexually assaulted two women who were customers in the store where she worked part-time. He was a recent graduate of art school and was working on the portfolio. And then he had kidnapped them to our home.
I'm just in shock listening to this. You must have felt so detached with that call.
That's an interesting term. I don't know if I would say detached. I felt just an extreme shock, horror. I really didn't even have, I mean, maybe I had a split second to think that it wasn't true, that there was some sort of mistake. But when he said he called 911 himself, I knew there was no mistake. I had spoken to him on the phone the night before. Whenever I was away traveling for work, we always had a ritual of tap at 10. And so when I called him at 10 o'clock the night before, actually, he didn't answer right away. And I thought, oh, it's garbage night. He's taking out the garbage. So I called back and he didn't quite sound like himself. And I asked him, are you feeling okay? And he said, actually, my stomach's a little upset. But don't worry, you know, just tell me about your day and tell me about the conference. And I teased him. I actually said, like, have you been eating junk food all weekend while I was away? Not in my worst nightmare could I imagine what had actually happened that would cause him to feel unwell, let alone have any way of knowing that as I prattled on about my time at the conference and I'd actually seen a keynote speaker that reminded me of Jason. It was somebody who'd really overcome a lot in his life. Could I have imagined that simultaneous to that, there were two women who in any other circumstance could have been my sisters, friends, colleagues, neighbors, that they were in my home, in the basement of my home, suffering in pain, in fear, injured, and also being incredibly brave in talking with Jason and essentially rehumanizing him, and then by talking to him about photos on the wall, do you have a girlfriend or is that your wife, with artwork and so on, to the point that he was able to actually apologize to them and go to a payphone close by and make that 911 call. That happened also after I spoke with him. So I think we all play a role then, the victims, you know, bravely and knowing what was going on in me unwittingly just by calling and I think playing a piece as Jason later told me, in grounding him and bringing him back to reality and back to them.
So you get this call from the police. I mean, you must have just felt like you were outside of your body getting this call. I can't imagine how you would have felt. What happens next?
So actually in person, the police, the officer was in my hotel room. I was at this conference. So, you know, really in that moment with the police officer there, and he was so kind and he waited with me. He first asked me to call the sergeant up in Peterborough to understand more fully, because this officer was from the Toronto Police Force. We lived in Peterborough, but I was in Toronto for a conference. And so I needed to call the sergeant. Couldn't tell me very much, but he said, we need you to come back right away. We need to interview you. And so then my next call was to my parents. My mom is a retired kindergarten teacher. She has that lovely voice. She answered the phone. Hi, Shan. How's the conference going? I said, get dad on the phone. Something terrible has happened. And I remember, you know, when they came, either the police officer waited with me. And, you know, I remember saying to him, because I was still the counselor, you know, I that was my role that I was used to. And I remember saying to him, how are you? This must be terrible for you, having to deliver bad news like this, because you just can't make such a extraordinary reversal of roles so quickly. So I was still the helper. Well, immediately though, I was going to be the one that was going to need so much help. And I looked out the window. I saw the airport, and it was like the whole world was still continuing to move. Planes were landing. There was morning traffic. But my world had come to a sudden and crashing halt. And I had an image come to mind as though a stone had flown up and hit a windscreen, hit the window actually of the hotel where I was. And I watched it with that same helplessness that happens when that stone hits your windscreen and you just have a second to think, you know, maybe the whole thing won't crack. And then you just watch that violent sneaking as everything shatters. And that was the image that I had in my mind. And that image eventually came to be on the front cover of the book that I wrote a few years later called Through the Glass, which really, you know, it is a double entendre in a way that it speaks to that shattered glass, that broken glass, and my journey to make some sort of mosaic out of that. And also refers to conversations I then had in the coming days and weeks and months with Jason through Prison Glass. Because he's the only one who had answers to the questions that I had. How could you do this? Why? What was going through your mind? Why didn't you tell me something was going wrong? And it was just so critical to be able to have those conversations, and it played a big role actually in my healing process, and also led me to advocate for restorative justice, which really is that victim-offender dialogue.
So from the time that this happened then to the time of you becoming a trauma therapist, what was the time frame of that?
Oh, well, what happened immediately after those crimes is I went from the first day, or, you know, the day before, where I was a respected educator, guidance counselor, and homeowner, newlywed, volunteer in my community, all those, you know, positive and bad titles, to the next day being the wife of a sex offender, having my house on the front page of the paper, the title, Monster Appears in Court. And bearing the burden of horrific stigma and judgment by many, not by all, and thank goodness for the people and he stood by me and walked with me through this journey. One of the worst things, if not, you know, there were so many terrible things that happened in the ripple effect of violent crime. For one, I learned that I had also been a victim of voyeurism. Jason had put up a camera in our home and filmed me and many other people on various occasions in the bathroom. I had to identify all those victims, watch all those videos, and then I was given official victim status in the justice system, even though I would say that is the least way in which I was victimized. What happened was that my job was taken away from me. My school board, superintendent, principal, in a re-entry meeting to discuss how I would come back to work, said, how could you be a good counselor when you were married to this guy? People are saying it's too difficult to see you. And they actually banned me from entering my school with their permission, and then said that I would be relocated outside of town when my doctor said I was ready to come, which is a modern day shunning. I didn't think that happened. There were a lot of things that I could never have imagined happening, both in the justice system and in community. I went home that day and was then diagnosed with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I had no more pay. I was put on leave without pay. I had benefits for a very short period of time. And that was really the biggest of the secondary traumas. So I believe that education always opens doors when doors are closing. And somehow in the fog of that unbelievable pain and trauma and fear, you know, just so much fear. I was afraid to go to the grocery store. I didn't know who I would see, how people would react to me. So I somehow applied to do a master's degree in social work. And then also, I don't really remember this part, but I applied for a fellowship for international study, which I was given. And so I went to England. I had to do a master's degree. And there I studied trauma. I studied restorative justice, and also got to be away from my community that I had loved and invested in so much, and be somewhere that I could be anonymous. After that, I moved to Toronto. Jason's trial amazingly went on for 2.5 years, even though he had called 911 himself. He had given the lead detective told me he'd never seen it before in 20 years of sex crime investigation, that Jason had given a statement that was an exact match to the statements of the four victims, were it not for the pronouns. And that he said at the end of his statement, should put me away forever. And this included also full confession and statement of responsibility. And it still took 2.5 years for him to have the opportunity to plead guilty in court and for anyone to give a victim statement, a victim impact statement. And then all that happened at the end of that day, so for this is 2008 by this time, is that on that day of sentencing, we listened to the victims give their statement. And, you know, my family and I, we just cried for them. I was never allowed and never been allowed to speak to them, offer them our help, which we wanted to do from the first moment that we found out what happened to them. We were quite alienated from them. I was told directly by, get this, a victim services counselor who I was allowed to see because of my official victim status, that he really wanted nothing to do with me and didn't think I was deserving of any help. When I asked her, please, is there anything we can do for the victims? And she just said, they don't need to hear from Jason's arena and go home. I gave a victim impact statement. My mom gave a statement. She'd also been a victim of the voyeurism. Jason gave a statement of accountability and apology. Judge gave a statement when he gave his ruling. And all that happened at the end of that day and at the end of 2.5 years was that one person was sent to prison for the rest of his life and everyone else was sent home. And that was it. And there was nothing for anyone. And I just remember thinking, what a ridiculous statement it is. Let justice be served. Because in that experience, I could see that nothing was going to be served to anyone. The only thing that would be served was the sentence. And that justice and healing was going to be up to each one of us.
And you walked home with a sentence of your own, really.
I did. Yeah. You know, which I really just had to make a decision that it wouldn't be a life sentence of PTSD, stigma, shame, shunning. I didn't think I deserved that. And I'd have responsibilities, people who love me. I love life. And I had to believe that there was something beyond this trauma. And two, witnessing, you know, my book, Through the Glass, is really a book of two journeys. One is my personal journey through grief, loss, stigma, shame. The other is as a journey, a journey as a witness on the justice system, the criminal justice system, which was just shocking. As a citizen, it was just shocking to see how it worked, how it doesn't work. And I just knew that after I could heal myself, or, you know, I'd done a lot of healing work, I think, for instance, day one of this journey, that I wanted to do something to help others. And that's the only way that I could make any sense out of the senselessness of everything that happened.
Victimhood, then, and there are people that it does become a life sentence for them.
Absolutely.
So how did you sort of break free from that? Was it a series of steps? Was it through intense therapy, mindset? What was it that pushed you through that so that it wasn't your life sentence? And how can people who are feeling like they have a sentence of their own break free of that?
You know, what I learned about being a victim is that the V stands for a bunch of really bad things. It stands for violated, vulnerable, voiceless. Voicelessness was a huge thing for me. Feeling that I never got to stand up for myself. And even vilified is another really bad V. So I knew that I needed to turn those Vs around and reclaim my vibrancy, find my voice. That was a huge, huge healing factor for me, finding my voice on the page and in terms of writing, as well as in terms of speaking and becoming a keynote speaker, or guest lecture at universities. That finding a voice helped to vindicate me when I could share what had really happened from my perspectives and shift what the assumptions were by so many when they heard that, for example, I was going to visit Jason at the jail. And as I said to you, I deserved to go and get the answers to my questions as much as possible.
Did you get the answers you wanted?
I got many of them. And then you get to a place where you have to accept that there are things that you'll never understand. And many of our conversations are recounted in my book and in other writing, which I felt it so important to share and give that nuanced version instead of, you know, what was being said or rumored about me with like, oh, she's it stand by her man, she, you know, the sort of what a pathetic loser this woman is, that real, you know, the vilification, as I mentioned, the judgment that befalls, especially a woman. Women form the vast majority of victims of crime. And men form the vast majority of people who commit crimes and are incarcerated. So that, for me, reversing those Vs, finding that voice, making a difference, being vindicated, was a huge part of my healing process. And then engaging in as much therapy as I could. You know, right now, we don't have any public funding for therapy. Many other health services in Canada are covered and not yet mental health. And so this is something that I really advocate for, you know, because what's interesting is that when we take care of our mental health, we also resolve many of our physical symptoms of stress and trauma. I did whatever I could. I had a wonderful family doctor who really became my main therapist, and I still see her a few times a year, because even when you get your PTSD well into remission through all of these things, she actually had me do ARC therapy. She offered me two different prescriptions. She offered me antidepressants or canvases on which I could try to express outwardly what I'd
gone through,
which was a wonderful. I took that prescription because I wanted to work through the worst. And come out the other side and try to create something beautiful from something so awful. So she was a real hero of mine, and we got my PTSD well into remission. And it can still be triggered to come out from time to time. And I think a lot of people will recognize that when we have grief and trauma, that we do so much work as much as we can. And we all, like, life continues to happen, you know, and so we have maybe a little extra vulnerability for those symptoms to come back, but you learn how to get them right back into remission as soon as you can. The other thing that helped me, you know, I think a lot, I work a lot with my clients on resilience building and what the various different R's are that go into resilience. So it's responsibility is one big thing, taking responsibility for your own healing. You know, recognizing that it's not really right. I mean, the person that did all the damage should be the one who has to clean it up. But I, you know, in my experience,
oh, you are preaching to the choir, sister. I I am cleaning up a big mess here. I'm not the focus of this podcast, but trust me, I know what you're coming from that one.
You know, that was a huge realization too for me about the jail and prison system, is that of course they work to protect society from dangerous people for as long as they're locked up, but they also protect those same people from facing up to what they've done. Let alone taking part in any sort of amends making or responsibility taking, restoration. Jason was in solitary confinement for 9 months. And there were times when things were so terrible and frightening and painful in the outside world, as we refer to as an inside world and outside world, for me, that I wanted to trade places with him. I wanted a quiet cell where someone would put 3 meals a day to a squat in my door so I could just think and be protected. I wanted protective custody.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought Jason should have to come home, clean up the mess, like literally clean up the mess. You know, police, when they search your home, they make more of a mess than there even was with a crime scene. And all of that I was responsible for cleaning up and asking a generous, amazing colleague to help me when he said, please, can I? And he helped me clean up the crime scene. you know, there, so there was that physical cleanup to do, and then there was the emotional cleanup. I thought Jason should have to answer for himself. I'm out, you know, being asked and being judged and all sorts of things, ask questions that I don't have the answers to that he does. And it just seemed, witnessing that and experiencing it, this was just so wrong. You know, so my journey, I mean, you originally asked, when did I become a trauma therapist? As a really, you know, a building path, I counsel a lot of people. Once my story went public, I just heard from hundreds, thousands of people that have been through either something similar, family members of people who offend, victims of crime, you know, just people who want to know that whatever they've gone through, if I could get through what I was getting through, they could get through what they want to get through. And did a lot of counseling. I developed a workshop with a close friend and colleague of mine whose husband had been murdered. And we called our workshop the F word, on exploring forgiveness and what it means and what it doesn't mean. We traveled across this country and even internationally to help people explore that new and what is my favorite F word. I like the other one too. I'm not going to lie.
Well, that is my favorite F word, but I have a lot of favorite F words, but forgiveness was not one. And I think people hearing your story for the first time today who are listening to this are probably surprised to hear that forgiveness is a huge theme in your work. So
yeah, it's pretty controversial.
It is, I think, because forgiveness is hard to give to somebody that's wronged you. So what role did it play in your healing journey? And why is it so important for victims to embrace that F word?
Yeah, I think, you know, the first thing I want to say is that I have never and will never forgive what Jason did. These crimes are unforgivable. The human being behind the horror is forgivable. I was very fortunate. Jason made forgiveness a lot easier for me because he was so accountable. And so remorseful and so apologetic. He even became the first person in Canada to accept the dangerous offender designation without a separate sentencing hearing as a way of showing his highest level of accountability by keeping himself in prison for the rest of his life. And we don't always have that. We don't always have people who are sorry for what they did to us. My school board, I tried to engage them in a sort of dialogue. I wanted healing from that because the repercussions of having been so stigmatized, as well as even the financial repercussions on me, going from having a salary, being a homeowner, to living on a tiny amount of employment insurance and all sorts of things. They had no remorse, no accountability, totally unwilling to have dialogue with me. And it really, in that case, I had to find what I call abstract forgiveness, which is forgiving someone or an institution or an organization that isn't sorry, that doesn't know what they did, that doesn't know the impact, that won't engage in dialogue. And I found that harder. But the thing that I, you know most or learn most about forgiveness is that, you know, people do criticize it. Sometimes they say, well, that's letting someone off the hook or that's being a pushover. I know that forgiveness can help set boundaries, close a relationship just as much as it can reopen one or help a relationship take a new shape. And I also know that forgiveness does let someone off. It's the person that offers it. And in the end, you know, even though at one point I offered my forgiveness to Jason, which he was unable to accept. I don't know that he has even now, 18 years later. But in offering that gift to him, it was really the greatest gift I could have given myself, because it was a way I found. If you picture, you know, being on a hook, like a fish on a hook, you know, who is in charge? Who's in charge of you? It's whatever you're hooked on, the anger, resentment, rage, blame, all those things. And for me, forgiveness just became the word that I could apply to a more graceful process of unhooking myself from all of that, all those energy and soul sucking forces, resentment and anger. Ugh.
So you can still, forgive somebody and demand accountability.
Oh, absolutely. These things for me go absolutely hand in hand. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you may never get the accountability,
right,
but you can still find the forgiveness.
Right.
And then it's opening up options for yourself. I mean, the thing about being a victim or being really harmed or whatever word you want to use is that someone has taken control of our lives without our permission. And so the healing process becomes about getting the reins of life back in our own hands. And so when we forgive someone, that's a choice that we have. Only we have the power to forgive someone else and, in a sense, forgive ourselves for even for being victims, even though it's not our fault. You know, we often associate forgiveness with fault, but it's so much more nuanced than that. Because and with my clients that I work with, most of whom have been victims of crime, victims of violent crime, now in my practice as a formal official trauma therapist that I have been for several years with my own practice, I hear people say all the time when they're recalling things even from childhood or things that have happened, the belief that is held somehow is it's my fault.
Yeah.
I was weak. I should have known better. I was naive. I, you know, shouldn't have been in that place at that time. And even sometimes we just want to take on the fault because the other person won't take it. You know, the person who actually caused him. So we take it on ourselves as a way almost of getting control, but it's a very negative control. So when we forgive ourselves and we say we are free again, we're free to live, we're free to trust, we're free to take another chance, we're free to have our grief, and we're free to feel joy again, then that's very, very empowering.
Let's talk about big T and little T traumas. I feel this is just observational, of course, but it feels like the world is traumatized right now, and it's messy. So how do you define the difference between a big T and a little T trauma, and what are some approaches to deal with those or treat them?
Yeah, great question. So big T trauma is the one that everyone knows. That's what I went to.
Sure.
Police officer arrives at your door. There's been a car accident. Your spouse cheats and everyone knew about it. You're in a war. There's an earthquake. Those are big T traumas. They're easy to recognize. Little T trauma is made up usually of a series of small hurts or slights, or hurts and slights that we get used to over time, but they build up and they can result in the exact same effect in terms of PTSD. Or CPTSD, which is complex post-traumatic stress disorder, it usually begins in childhood. So we can look at things like oppression, racism, homophobia, things like that, bullying, where people are sort of putting up with these daily or weekly or, you know, however it plays out, hurts. They form the same types of beliefs as forming major trauma. Like, I'm powerless, I'm voiceless, I'm not in control, I'm not worthy, I don't deserve love, these types of things. And when we hold those beliefs, that's the worst part of trauma, is what we come to believe about ourselves. That's the longest term. In addition, of course, I'm saying that reverence for our obvious losses or loss of life and loss of home, things like that. But it's in terms of psychological damage. What happens in trauma is that we have bad thoughts that can be about ourselves that can become beliefs. And so when people fundamentally believe about themselves, let's say by being a victim of racism, and constantly having to operate in a world that is not friendly or not nearly as friendly to you or welcoming, is that you might grow up to believe, I'm not worthy, I'm less than, I'm voiceless. If you hold those types of beliefs for whatever reason, maybe your parents were alcoholics and never took care of you. We make decisions in a very different way, but if we believe I'm not worthy or I'm not lovable, I'm not good enough, then we make, if we believe I'm good, I'm worthy, I can make mistakes, these types of positive beliefs. So trauma therapy really is about transforming your negative beliefs back into positive beliefs about yourself by coming to terms with what has happened, by reprocessing in the brain. And then therefore, when you're sealed, it's that you believe fundamentally, you really truly believe, not just with your mind, but with your body. Because we know sometimes our minds will say like, of course I'm a good person. But actually, you know, in my body, I'm experiencing a lot of anxiety and stress, control, stomach upset, tension, all these things that tell me I don't actually believe that. But when we actually believe good things about ourselves, we act good, we make good decisions, we are healthy, and that has a really positive ripple effect. So thinking about the world now, you know, I think the pandemic, the second pandemic we're in right now is a mental health crisis.
Yeah.
And we had a lot of people endure big T trauma, sudden job loss, loss of income, displacement, maybe the things that came from that, loss of life, loss of health. We also have an enormous amount of little T trauma. Little T trauma in that being isolated. We saw people die from the little T trauma of not having any physical touch with another person, any close connection, those types of things. So the thing about little T trauma, or I call it woodpecker trauma, which I think is a good visual. You can kind of see a woodpecker, just like what a beautiful bird.
Yeah.
On a tree. We don't really notice right away the power of that woodpecker to take down an entire forest. So we have to recognize that that pecking, that little T trauma, can have the same effect as big T trauma. And so we're in a time right now where I think the disaster, so to speak, is over, but we're in rebuilding. And we have to rebuild our society, our communities, with mental health as one of the key essential components to sustainability, which means acknowledging and recognizing that most of us, many of us, are not doing particularly well because we are still feeling the effects of isolation, of friendship loss, family member loss, not even loss of life, but loss of, you know, how we interacted with people.
Mm-hmm.
Huge amounts of stress, people acting out against one another. And now we're coming back into society and it looks largely the same, but it doesn't feel the same. We are not the same as we were before the pandemic.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. It's amazing to me that our government is not putting more focus on mental health. It's shameful. And to even find a therapist is very difficult right now for people. And I realize that there are options with online.
Yeah.
But that's not the same to me. I think it's a good option if it's the only option available, but it is not the same as connecting with a therapist in person.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, I would say, like, for online therapy, many of us I actually did online therapy prior to this because of my specialization in working with people whose family members have found, and I had clients all over the world. But most of us, I think, really work very hard to increase our skills. I can provide, for example, EMDR therapy, eye movement desensitization reprocessing therapy online, to the same level of effectiveness And what is so good about being able to access online therapy is you really can, it's like a home visit, it's like a old-fashioned home visit, which is good when you can't get out of your home, when you have limited time, when you live in a remote place. If you're looking for a specialist like me and you live in a small community, or you live in a small community where you happen to know all the therapists, or they're your aunts and uncles, you know? It's, so there's really, really, really good things about online therapy. In-person therapy is incredible, you know, just because it, and I love, you know, now having more people, Toronto-based people anyway, coming in person, because there's something about, first of all, leaving your house. That's a good thing.
I was just going to say that. I was literally going to say, for me, it is the whole process of it. It's leaving the house, going to, you know, to a designated place to sort of have that safe space to share and discuss. And then you leave again, and you leave feeling, usually you leave feeling better because you know, you've got a plan now. You've talked through some things, you've worked through something. So I love that you said even the process of going, because that is how I feel.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I just moved out of my home office. I had a beautiful home studio in my Toronto, detached Toronto garage. I remade, fortunately, before the pandemic, into a four-season studio. But I just moved to an outside of Fitness because I also need to have some separation between my work as a trauma therapist and, you know, going home to my families. And some of the work I do is pretty high profile right now, for example, on the Peter Nygaard investigation. And that it's just nice to have a little bit of separation. But the whole process of taking that time for yourself, even when you're going home from therapy or going back to your office, you have a little bit of a commute time.
Yep.
And what I like to say to people, or to people who are listening now about therapy, is that, I mean, people often ask me, gosh, isn't it, your work must be so depressing, you know, like you're dealing with horrible stuff. And I just say, actually, no, because everyone who walks through my door or appears on my screen are all very brave humans who have said, I'm gonna clean out the junk drawer of my life. Mm-hmm. And that's what I kind of liken it to, is we all have a junk drawer in our house. We stuff things in there. It's we'll just put that there for now. As long as we can close the drawer, for the most part, we're okay, we're still functioning. But every time we open it, the stress, the strain, the overwhelm happens. And it's so great to have someone who can help you sort through and reorganize your junk drawer. And that's what therapists do. That's what we are. That, you know, on a home visit, when I was writing my second book, which is the story of a human trafficking survivor, Tamia Nagy, there's no worse income than being a best-selling author in Canada. I'll just say that. So I operated a side hustle of a home organization stage, you know, with that, because I love design. I love fashion. All my work really is so gritty. So I have these pretty pastimes. And it was like a home visit. And I could actually see how therapeutic it is when I would help people open up the junk drawer. We're going to go through this. Yeah. And so in therapy, you're doing the same thing. It often feels worse before it feels better, because if you just picture, you pull out that drawer in your kitchen cabinet or your kitchen island, your desk drawer, and you dump it all on the counter. Well, now it's bigger than ever. Mm-hmm. You know, now, at least when it was in the drawer, you could sort of close it. Now there it is. It's all laid there. But the process of therapy then is to really look through that stuff and find out what really just needs to be thrown away. What is just garbage that, you know, we just need to throw away? What can be repaired? What can find a place? And what are the things, the treasures in there that you forgot you had? And that's a beautiful part of trauma therapy, is when we realize we have treasures. We have aspects of ourselves and our personalities that maybe have been clouded or have been damaged by what we've been through. And when you take those things out and shine them up because you're getting rid of other things, it just becomes such a wonderful way to then operate in the world, in your family, in your relationships, with an organized, quote unquote, junk drawer or treasure chest.
I love that analogy.
Yeah. You just feel that you can handle things a lot better. And so what I want to say to people listening is, it is hard to find a therapist right now. I know I have a long waiting list I just brought on, and I'm bringing on a new therapist into my practice. I recruit them out of other places where they're working so they can be in private practice, because private practice therapists, we, really put a huge emphasis on training and specialization. But if you can find a therapist or get yourself on a waiting list as soon as you can, for when the time comes, just know that at the beginning, you might feel a little worse about everything that's in your mind, your life experiences, but you'll feel better by having someone to hold your hand through that process, someone to companion you and guide you with soft skills as well as the hard skills of understanding brain science and how things work.
You're incredible. I literally cannot wait to meet you in real life tomorrow. your story, people can't see me, but my jaw was on the ground, I think, for most of it. It's just incredible. So I can't thank you enough for being so open and sharing this with people and sharing your story, because it helps when you talk about, you know, what you go through. It helps somebody else understand that they can make it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Okay, we're going to put all of the links so people can find you and find your book and read all about this and maybe, hopefully, if they're in Toronto, meet you for therapy. So thank you so much for joining me today, Shannon.
Thanks, Candace.
If you liked today's episode, please take a moment to share it with others. Also, be sure to subscribe to What She Said Talk with Candace Sampson on your favorite podcast provider. Stay up to date with my newsletter by signing up at whatshesaidtalk.com, and be sure to follow on social at What She Said Talk on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for videos of these interviews and more. You can also catch me on TikTok at Candace Said. Finally, you can catch What She Said on the radio weekly in Toronto, Ottawa, and Surrey.
Hey, listeners, I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa. And this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers. She said she enjoyed hurting things that can't fight back.
And that is a disturbing view into the mind of a murderer. And such a dirtbag.
Yeah, that's not even strong enough words. This is totally a recipe for disaster. And not to justify whatever is going to happen, but you can totally understand and see how this would be in the works.
If you were only to look at what she did later on and not know any of that history, she would appear like off the wall crazy.
Oh, 100%. Because we're not even close to getting to the end yet. But you can just see this pattern and all this kind of stuff developing in her, which is what we're here for. We're digging deep.
Join us each Thursday as we unearth the dirt bags that live among us
and the motives buried there. Hope you join us as we exhume the truth.
I'm Andrea Askowitz.
And I'm Allison Langer. And we are the hosts of Writing Class Radio, a podcast, but we are so much more. We have writing classes. So if you are looking for live online classes where you can join a community, write to a prompt, get feedback, and get better, check out all our classes at writingclassradio.com.
And listen to our podcast wherever you get your podcasts and at writingclassradio.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.